I don't think so, Dr. Hero. We can look out there somebody. One, two, three. You have, it looks like four members, right? Well, Dr. Blazek just joined. So that's five.
Dr. Christensen is actually delayed in surgery. He will not be joining for a little bit.
Okay, so you have four. So,
I'm here.
And now, go ahead.
So we have doctors Laut, Blazek, myself, and Snell.
Yeah. And everybody didn't respond to the poll. But of those that did, I think 8 of 11, well, 10 responded. And 6 said they would be here. So we will have a quorum if the 6 that said they would be here will be here. I don't know. Who was that?
Allie.
Oh, Ali Begay. Mm-hmm. Well, there is. He would be 6 if Dr. Christensen were here, but he looks like he's going to be held up for a little bit. Give me 1 second. I'll tell you who else. Dr. Brady said he would be here, but he would be a little bit late. But he was going to attend. Dr. German won't be. Dr. Beanstalk won't. And I don't know who the 2 are that didn't respond. Let me see if I could figure it out. Oh, Dr. Brownstein didn't respond. Oh, and Dr. Christensen, but we know what's going on here. So either Dr. Brownstein needs to come because everybody else has already said no.
Tell Eddie's, have Eddie's assistant take the, take the computer into his operatory. He can listen.
And we don't even have an attorney present, do we? The meetings are getting a little more challenging, Dr. Hero. To one, get a quorum, and now we don't even have an attorney. Let me see what's going on with that.
Dr. Arnell, I see your hand up. We haven't been able to start the meeting yet, though. Oh, great. Thanks, Dr. Arnell. He just messaged that Dr. Brady should be here any minute. And that'll give us a quorum.
Yeah. Dr. Christensen's assistant, I'll just say, because I don't have a name. Will you let us know when he actually joins? Because right now, well, I'm going to put him down as absent, just in case he doesn't ever come, but we'll need to know exactly when he comes. There's Dr. Brady.
Great.
Well, yes. I'm sorry. I'll let you know. My name's Bobby Joe. I'm going to take the audio on his phone into the operatory. I know he's in a difficult surgery, so I will see what I can do to get him joined in.
I think we're okay if he just wants to wait, because I think we do. Dr. Brady, almost called you Jason. Dr. Brady joined in, and we have a quorum with Dr. Brady.
Jason's just fine for me. I'm here. Thank you.
Well, then it is 2:35. Let's call the meeting to order. Sherry, you want to give us a roll call?
Yes. Hero?
Yes.
Begay?
Yes.
Blazek?
Yes.
Brady?
Here.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Here.
Absent ours, Brownstein, Beanstalk, and then Christensen's unavailable right now. And Jermaine.
Agenda item number two, I'm going to make a motion that we approve the open session meeting minutes from September 16th.
I second the motion.
Motion and a second. Sherry, let's get a roll call.
Hero?
Yes.
Bagai?
Yes.
Blazek?
Yes.
Brady?
Yes.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Yes.
Motion passes, none opposed. Jessica, are you here with us?
I am. Can you guys hear me?
We can. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll turn it over to you now for agenda item number three, where we left off R411-1303.
Okay, give me one second. Okay, so this is where we left off. We're in Rule 1302, and we are talking about the pediatric endorsement. I'm just trying to get my screen to a point where you guys can actually see what I can see. Okay. So right now we have a Section 1302 permit holder who has obtained a pediatric endorsement according to subsection C and who administers moderate sedation to a pediatric patient shall ensure, one, the following additional persons are present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure. And I guess we can go ahead and jump into the questions and comments you have there. Because one of the questions was, what does that mean, critical portion of the procedure?
Yeah, Allie.
So I'm just curious, the language that we have in here, is it, it's exactly what we had in the 1301 section R regarding this information?
Correct.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it probably needs some pretty considerable tweaking since this is going to be, you know, IV conscious sedation or, you know, moderate sedation as opposed to general anesthesia. So, I'm not sure if critical portions of the procedure really need to be defined. I worry that when you get into too many definitions in these rules, that it kind of gets a little crazy. But there is a lot in here that probably needs to be tweaked overall. And it's kind of like where to start. The whole section kind of needs to be rewritten.
Any other comments or discussion? Dr. Caputo.
I think you should just get rid of it. You should just say the following additional persons are present with the patient during the procedure. I don't need to say critical portion. Obviously, I've mentioned my concerns about how you're defining who that person is, but I think if you have a patient who's under any level of sedation, minimal to deep or GA, regardless, somebody should always be with them. And if not one, but three has always been the consistent number. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying during the procedure that identifies from start to finish. And I think that's where you should leave it. Thank you.
Jason.
So I think there is some ambiguity a little bit by design because let's say the parent wants more information from the doctor and they've already done x-rays during this procedure, or they have the assistant trying to get additional informed consent with the parent and the patient is in a stable condition under general anesthesia. It may be something that you're using clinical judgment so that if the parent has a pressing question about a treatment change that has done, it gives them that ability. So I think that is why there's a little bit of up to interpretation for this, although you don't want to write rules that way. But I just don't know if being more prescriptive, saying the whole procedure, are we talking about the dental procedure or the anesthesia procedure portion of that? So I get it. I think that's why it's that way, but that's my concern with it.
Anthony.
That's the point. I mean, you just pointed it out exactly, Jason. You don't put critical in there because you don't want to be prescriptive. You want to say during the procedure, and everybody understands that no one is ever going to say, oh my God, you have to be in the room. Absolutely. There are always going to be times to leave. It happens all the time. It happens in the OR. We all know that. And that's why you don't want to make it any more restrictive than it needs to be. So instead of trying to define when someone may have left the room with a critical time or not, you automatically just say you have to use your best judgment. That's already implied in the rules. And I think that's the whole point of making it more broad. Thank you.
Randy.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Dr. Caputo that taking out that credit, just, you know, the poor, you know, be with the patient for the procedure. And I think number two is really a different item. That's more about what's happening after the procedure is done and how patients are being recovered. And so in one fashion, I'm pretty much okay with section two. But I do believe section one should be pared down and take out that word critical for sure. It leaves up too much for interpretation.
Jason.
No, I agree with both statements. I'm just saying that if we go back to it during the procedure, I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole thing is like, I can see it both ways, essentially. Like saying critical portion makes it less the one way you're interpreting it, but the other way it makes it more prescriptive too. So I don't know if there's a way to say the intent of this is that we have these staffs during the procedure. And how do you write that with some variance? That's my question, but maybe it's fine just to say procedure.
Allie, if you guys put on messages, I just put suggested adjustments to this language. If you guys want to look at what I put over there, I changed it to saying the following additional persons are present with the patient during the sedation, right? Because we're really concerned more with the sedation than the procedure, right? And then I took out ACLS being acceptable and changed it as PALS or has accredited from the board approved assistant course, second person BLS. And then for the recovery period, someone with PALS for a board approved assistant course. Just thought I'd put some actual language out there for everybody to kind of look. That's kind of where our heads are at. Jason.
I guess I still have the same question during the sedation. What does that actually mean? I mean, sedation doesn't stop when you stop giving drugs, or, you know, sedation lingers on to that point. It just is, there's some like wonkiness to this whole thing, the way that I'm reading it. And I guess to Caputo's point, he's correct. Like, that's the intent. I just don't know how to read it correctly to that intent.
Anthony?
Christensen's here.
All right, Eddie, welcome.
Thank you.
So to Ali's comment, what you have to remind yourself of, for a 1302 permit holder, they're the person doing the procedure. They're doing the dentistry and the sedation. So saying the procedure is all-encompassing there. So I think you're recognizing that it's all happening at the same time. So the dentist would not be doing one without the other. They go hand in hand, and it sort of carries Jason's point forward. When does sedation start and stop? So I think the point back to what you're saying, Jason, though, is you just don't want more language than that leads it up. So one of the lenses that it would be helpful to look at some of these statements from is, how would you adjudicate this if there was a violation? Okay, so coming from, I'm putting on my investigative committee hat, and one of the issues that comes up is, okay, what does that language exactly mean? Well, the more the language is up for interpretation, the greater the challenge the committee that's reviewing that violation has and how they interpret it. So I have to tell you that leaving it more general is generally speaking, huh, no pun intended, better for an interpretation standpoint than it is being more prescriptive or specific. So it's not that you lose the meaning or you lose the intent by removing that word. You just allow for those who might be looking at that later a better or broader sense of interpretation. Thank you.
Jason?
Yeah, and quite honestly, by definition, if you say procedure, they're going to have to make that clinical judgment whether it's safe for them to go back out to talk to the parent or not.
Exactly. And
regardless of his critical portion or just procedure, which I'm kind of leaning towards the whole procedure thing. If they have a bad day during that point, they miss the mark completely.
Ali?
Yeah, I think we're all thinking the same thing. It's just, how do we put it into the rules to make it make sense, right? The reason I was thinking changing it from procedure to sedation would be, you know, if the permit holder starts sedation, we don't want them to then be able to step out of the room for 5, 10, however long minutes, and then come back and commence the procedure. So that was kind of my thought in changing it to sedation from procedure. And then based on what you guys were saying, and this, you know, especially what Dr. Brady was saying, was when do you transition from, you know, that the permit holder needs to be there to this, you know, number two. I added one thing, but I think what it's saying in two is that you're still going to be in level one where you need the three people there until you hit these moments in number two, which is that the patient's oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable. And then I just added in the last one saying after completion of the procedure. So I'm wondering if that might get where we're trying to go, right? So you need three people during, once sedation starts, until you hit into two, which is the procedure's over. And then you have a patient that's stable, oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation. Is that getting us where we want to be to make it make sense?
Jessica, in a minute, you know, hearing this discussion, I'd love to hear if you got any recommendations, but Dr. Snell, why don't you go ahead, let your hand up.
Just looking back at letter, I believe it's K. It says the section 1302 permit holder shall continuously supervise the patient from the initiation of moderate sedation until termination of the moderate sedation procedure and oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable. If we've already used language like that, can we not just mimic that, since that's, I think, what we're all trying to intend, and it's already been written.
This is Jessica. Were you referring to, did you say 1303?
1302K.
K.
I mean, obviously the extra team members that are in the room that we're referring to with the pediatric aren't supervising, but that language of, you know, continuously being there during the sedation procedure. I mean, even that, to Jason's point, if I had to step out as the provider to go talk to mom, I mean, I could even argue that technically that's holding me to the room, but I think we all understand the intention there that if I have to step out for 2 minutes and come back or 30 seconds or whatever it might be, that's okay. But it just seems that language has been used and we all agree to it. And maybe we could use that similar language for what we're trying to figure out here.
So
Anthony?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to say, so if you have K already and you're all comfortable with that, do you really need the beginning portion of R, or is R really just saying who else has to be in the room besides the permit holder who's already continuously supervising the patient?
I think this is for pediatrics, so you'd have to have, we're discussing the additional people in the room, correct? So we would need what we're trying to say here because it's specific to pediatric patients or those with a pediatric designation.
Yes, but this also might be another perspective here is the protection of the patient, right, from a safety perspective. We don't want to have the opportunity for one person to be alone with a sedated patient for various reasons and purposes. So I do think that having language that indicates that additional staff people are present during the procedure is appropriate for duplication. I don't think there should be any instance that you would want language that could be interpreted or understood that only one person needs to be with the patient when they're under some level of sedation or anesthesia. So I think that's why it's worthwhile to duplicate it in that instance. But I also think, to be consistent with what Heath mentioned, the word procedure is used, and I think that is enough, and I think it sends the message. Now, if you want to say sedation procedure, that's fine, but I don't think you need to get too beat up on this, but certainly critical doesn't need to be there. So thank you.
Any more comments, or Jessica, you got a suggestion for us?
Yeah, it kind of sounds like maybe we can take out the word critical portion and just say during the procedure. Or I think the other suggestion was to mimic the language from K.
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I think just change it to procedures and move on unless there's someone objecting to this at this point. I mean, I just don't see a better way of wordsmithing this. Really, the intent is there from everyone. And I don't know if we can get through a lot of this with just more intent focus and then have someone wordsmith it to revisit we get caught up in these little semantics of things, but I'm fine with just going with procedure on this.
Ali?
The only other thing I'd change in this section, I don't know if we're just focusing on one now, but I don't think that ACLS, is, if we're talking about pediatrics, I don't think ACLS is an appropriate certification for this section. I think it should be PALS or the, you know, one of these accredited board-approved courses.
Anthony?
I'm not exactly sure where this might come up, but I'm just curious if this committee is considering any type of grandfathering for some of these new rules that might go into place. And with that grandfathering, will there be a transition, meaning that if folks were seeing pediatric patients with their current permit level, would they be permanently grandfathered based on the time of the reception of their permit, or do they grandfather to this so that they have to start following these pediatric recommendations if that applies to them? Is that something you guys have done? I just don't know. Thank you.
Well, let's take Ollie's comment first. Committee members have a recommendation on removing or leaving ACLS. Jason.
So we're talking about someone, and I understand that the PALS, there's a difference between PALS and ACLS, but I think as that additional person that's in there, if they have ACLS, then they have cardiac life support training. So I'm fine with both of them being in there. I'm fine either way. But I think it just gives a little bit more of another avenue for someone to have another credential.
Heath? I'd back Jason on that. And because to have this pediatric designation, the provider has to have PALS. So you got someone in the room with PALS, and then these other additional team members are just there to support. And if they have ACLS or PALS, but it broadens the ability for them to have one of those certifications, then I think that's sufficient. So I would vote to leave it the way it's written to give the options.
This is Christensen. I'd agree with that as well, what Brady and Snello said.
Ali? I mean, I'm not going to die on this hill, but there is a big difference between PALS certification and ACLS certification. I mean, caring for adults and kids is very, very different, and you want the person that's going to help you in a crisis to know how to deal with children. So I'm not going to die on the hill. I just really disagree with you guys that ACLS should be acceptable as your support staff who's going to help in a crisis in this kind of situation. Dr. Caputo, to your question, I think we should circle back around to that at a different time. Let's try to get through more of these rules for now.
That's fine. I just wasn't sure if that's something you were addressing currently or coming up later. Thank you.
Thanks. Just to what Dr. Caputo asked, I think we did address it, right? Wasn't it like 2 years? There's no grandfathering, right? But isn't it 2 years? And then to get the pediatric endorsement, you have to show that you've done 15 pediatric cases in those 15, in those 2 years or something.
Yeah, this is loud. I think we discussed it when people were coming up on the renewal. Then it would be applicable if I remember correctly. Or new applicants.
I agree. That's correct, Dr. Lau. We said 20 in the past 2 years as it comes up for renewal.
Correct.
Then, Jessica, you think we're okay to move on?
Yes. So do you want to keep the ACLS, or do you want to get rid of it, or do you want me to make a note to revisit it?
I think the consensus was to leave it with.
Okay. Okay, that brings us then to the next comment, still in subsection A, talking about or who has accreditation from a board-approved assistant course. The comment here was, should this be removed? And I think the question here was, does the board actually approve assistant courses?
Ryan, do you want to take that question?
This is Sherry, board staff, and no, we do not approve dental assistant courses, or do we regulate dental assistants?
Thank you, Sherry.
It's all handled by DAMBI, the National Association.
What was that, Ryan? I'm sorry.
It's all handled by DAMBI, and it's DAMB, which is Dental Assisting National Board.
How come in some states they do actually have regulation then or oversight of the dental assistants, whereas ours doesn't?
It's a great question. This state, we actually have some dental assisting language in both statute and rule, but there's no regulation of dental assistants in the state of Arizona. And I don't know. I mean, it's a legislative issue. This is one of the things that's driven me crazy. One of the many that's driven me crazy since I've been employed here.
Jason, then we'll go to Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to Sherry's point, if the board doesn't have a mechanism for this, then they can't be there. The idea, I think, behind this was, you know, maybe there's a really good airway course that's out there, or there's a really good simulation course that's out there. Or even pairs that's out there. There's a lot of different alternatives than just what the AHA says that could be really helpful for supportive staff, especially since really the driving force of PALS and ACLS is to have that team dynamic, but it's the leader that's going to be saying either accepting or dismissing input from staff. So I hate to say take it out, but if that's what we have to do because we don't have a mechanism, that's fine. But I do think, and it's been voiced before, there's other things that are out there, you know, that that especially with the supportive staff. I'm not talking about the sedationist, the dentist, or whoever that may be with the permit holder, but the supporting staff. So if there's no mechanism for the board to do that, then I think you have to take it out.
Anthony, did you have a comment? You got your hand raised before.
Yeah, I just lowered it. But what if you just changed it to board accepted? To Jason's point, there are tremendous assistant courses out there that DAMBI may or may not even know about. But the onus is on the permit holder to train their staff, right? And so we're saying to the permit holder, you need to train your staff, and it needs to be a board accepted course. And I think that would allow a mechanism to where the board could have courses that it's reviewed either internally or through consultants that say we accept these courses. And I think that's a very easy thing to do and actually something that we should do. And that would then fulfill that instead of being board approved, it would just be board accepted. Thank you.
This is Christensen. I'd agree with that.
Randy?
Yes, and I was just going to follow. You know, there's 14 other states in this country that do exactly that. And I know everyone, I know all of them that have developed this language in the statutes. So I think it's appropriate that Arizona does it. I don't know if we need to have council input on it. I'd prefer not to, but we ought to do something about it and indicate in some fashion that we, you know, we think it's a good idea that we have continued training and it's up to the sedationist or the person providing the anesthesia to make sure that the staff is trained and there to support.
Ryan, do you have a comment on the suggestion about removing board approved to board accepted?
I don't really have any comment. I would actually probably defer to Jessica. She sees this quite a bit more often than me. I'm not a huge fan of either, I'll be honest, and board accepted I think sounds easier to swallow than board approved. But I don't know, Jessica wants to provide an opinion on that. I know it's not legal advice, but Seamus is on too. He could give you legal advice on that comment.
Yeah, so typically I would say that you shouldn't have anything that in your rules that talks about being board approved unless the board actually has a way to approve. Because you'd be looking at that from two different standpoints. One, you're going to have providers who want to know who is and isn't board approved. And two, you're going to have the course providers who want to know how they can be listed as approved. And if there's no mechanism or statutory authority behind that to create a mechanism in rule, then you're going to have a bit of an issue there.
Jason.
So in Mississippi, they have an anesthesia advisory committee that, like we do here, but we review these with the course director. We review the content. Sometimes we've had invitations to go out and actually take the course, but we do interviews with people, participants, and then we give the recommendation to the board to go through that process. But it's, you know, things in Mississippi are quite a bit different than they are in Arizona as far as this whole entire process. So it just may not be a mechanism that's there. And what Jessica is saying, it just seems like there's not. So I think we have to deal with what we have unless there's something that we can press to put that mechanism into place.
So Heath, I was just going to chime in. I think it would be nice to have. I'm not opposed to it, but given the parameters that we're putting into work in, I don't see how we keep it there. So let's remove it if those that have the moral authority and the, you know, more understanding of the rules and stuff than we do, remove it. And I'd say let's continue on.
So change to board accepted and move forward.
If we can do board accepted, that'd be great. If not, then take the whole thing out.
I think you would have the same issue with board accepted as you do with board approved. The issue is going to be, how does the board accept or not accept one of these course providers, and how can a dental provider go and find out whether or not the course is accepted by the board?
Sorry, just one more thing. It says right here, so this is basically the third individual in the room we're talking about, right? So they have to have BLS, so they're going to have an understanding of basic life support. This just opens it up to allow them to have something more, but I would think all of us have team members that are helping us in our sedation cases that are BLS trained at this point, so I don't really see it as like taking a major step backwards. If they don't have one of these additional assistant courses, I think they'd be wonderful, but given the fact that the board can't regulate that, then we just say they have BLS and move on. It's the third provider. They've got BLS. They understand basic life support. And that's what we can do within our parameters that we have right now in the state.
Randy.
I would agree with Dr. Snell about moving on, because I do think it's out of our purvey to make this change in this level. This might be something we attack after we get these statutes changed. But I will say that I think on a personal note, Eddie and I would love to see our state come in line with what the American Association of Maxillofacial Surgeons are doing, which is let's perpetuate this team model. And let's make sure that the third person in the room, or that second person at least, is some type of advanced trained assistant. But maybe we can't do it in this fashion, and I get it. So out of the interest of time, we don't need to beat a dead horse.
Okay, Heath.
Just one thing for Jessica, if it changes here, this language is the same in 1301, so it should probably be removed there as well.
Yes.
Okay, so Ali, go ahead.
Just one clarifying thing, because it seems like the committee would like it to be able to have the board do this, but just so I understand, in order for the board to be able to provide an endorsed or approved or whatever program for dental assistance, that would require a statutory change, which means legislation.
Ryan, do you want to take that?
No, that's correct.
Okay, thanks.
So, Jessica, you want to remove that last portion of the sentence and we can move forward?
Yes. So I'll remove it from subsection B, and then I'll remove it from number two as well. So you've got, what you're left with is the 1302 permit holder who has obtained a pediatric endorsement according to subsection B and who administers moderate sedation to a pediatric patient shall ensure the following additional persons are present with the patient during the procedure. One person who has a current certification in PALS or ACLS, and one person having a current certification in basic life support healthcare provider level endorsed by the American Heart Association or ACLS, and a person who has a current certification in PALS ACLS and monitors the patient after the patient's oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable until the patient meets criteria for discharge using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system.
Any more comments? If not, then let's move forward.
Okay. So that's going to bring us down to 1303, which is moderate sedation via an oral route.
Heath.
So I think we're going to have to change all that, Jessica, because I put that in when we were sticking with the 1302 as a moderate sedation via parenteral route, and the 1303 was moderate sedation via an oral route. But since we've just defined a 1302 as simply moderate, then my suggestion would be to make 1303 just minimal sedation and not have a route tied to it. I don't know what everyone else's thoughts are, but
Jessica, could you put the definition of minimal sedation up? Because I think that might, if we call this section minimal, that may create some issues for our pediatric dentist. But Dr. Lout, why don't you got your hand up? Why don't you speak to that?
Yeah, there's kind of an evolution with this. I think we shot to a higher level when we first were in early talks about rewriting. Section. I'm certainly fine if you want to go minimal. The pediatric world is kind of in between. You obviously don't want to get too much to the moderate, try to keep things minimal. But I think during the process of rewriting and then meeting with the pediatric subgroup, I know Dr. Brady was part of that group. I think that somehow or another it ended up being moderate. So I'm comfortable with it being minimal if that help the process, but it's kind of a thing that could go either which way.
Is the minimal definition, does it limit it to one drug? And would a pediatric dentist want to be limited to one drug via an oral route?
Well, the thing is most of the literature and the pediatric guidelines and everything, if it's one drug, it's considered minimal. If you start adding drugs, it's considered moderate. So I know that some and most pediatric dentists, some just use one drug, others use a combination of other drugs, which kind of leans more towards moderate.
Yeah, and so I guess, you know, I would have some concern about those pediatric dentists that maybe have been using multiple drugs via an oral route for a long time now being limited to how they can practice. Again, this is your world, Dr. Lout, and I'll defer to what you think, but I did want to pose
a question. And I think that's one of our reasons for putting some more criteria in the pediatric section is to make people are more experienced, that they met academic guidelines, that they're prepared to, you know, be aware of the minimal moderate and the drugs used and the PALs and everything that goes along with a sedated child.
Ollie?
Yeah, my understanding is that a dentist without a permit can provide minimal sedation with two doses of the same medication. So, you know, this section isn't just for pediatrics, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood that a dentist without a permit can give minimal sedation.
Well, in their office. My understanding is if you have one drug, it's okay. If you add another drug, say nitrous, then it's considered sedation with a permit required.
So
not to jump in, but just to answer that, I think that's addressed just a couple paragraphs down from where we're looking, where it says under number two, the administration of a single drug for minimal sedation does not require a permit if, and then it expands on that. But the way I read this was that a permit is not required if a single drug is given even with nitrous oxide. But I think some clarification would be good, because that was, I think a lot of licensees out there have questions on that and some confusion on that.
Happy to clarify.
Go ahead, Anthony.
So the way the current rules read is that a dentist whose intention is minimal sedation can administer a single drug up to 1.5 times the MRD. So effectively, they can't give, and not to say that Ali was saying this, but that second dose can't be equivalent. It has to be, generally speaking, half the amount of the initial dose. So you're basically not able to double dose, and it can be with or without nitrous, is the way the language reads, as long as the intention is minimal sedation. And I think one of the reasons why that's clumsy, even though that's the current language, is kind of what you guys are struggling with right now anyways. And that is, you're trying to define minimal or moderate sedation based on the number of drugs or the doses of drugs, when that's not what the definitions say at all. The definition, clearly the two words that are defining minimal and moderate sedation are normal and purposeful, with the idea that when a patient is sedated, they may have a delayed response or need a more directed initiation of response for them to get a response back to the dentist, which would then say that's a purposeful response versus a normal response. So I think what you want to do is not get caught up too much in the number of drugs, but really what the level is indicating. If you have a normally responsive patient, regardless of what drugs are on board, that's minimal sedation. If you have a purposely responsive patient, regardless of the drugs on board, that's moderate sedation. And that's probably where you want to have your conversation versus trying to do numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. What I was suggesting wasn't related to the number of drugs. What I was just saying was, if dentists without a permit can provide minimal sedation, requiring a permit for minimal sedation doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. My thought was, we keep this moderate sedation via an oral route, and then 1302 is moderate sedation via oral or IV route. So I guess I was bringing up the fact that a dentist without a permit can give minimal sedation. It wouldn't really make sense to make this section only minimal sedation.
Heath, you had your hand up, and then Dan, did you want to speak?
So I mean, it could go a lot of different ways, and I don't know that I have a strong opinion on what we do. If we keep the 1302 as moderate sedation, period, which is what we had talked about before, I don't know does it matter to have a 1303 that says moderate with oral sedation? I mean, it's moderate sedation is moderate sedation to what even what Anthony said, not only the number of drugs, but the route. I think that's what we were trying to get away from the beginning was we're not defining sedation by the route of administration. Sedation is defined by the level, regardless of the route that's used. And so, and that's where the new definitions are. The verbiage that's there with the routes being used is old language. So if we define 1302 as a moderate sedation, I had mentioned if we do that, that's going to be vast sweeping changes for lots of people, not just pediatric dentists, but there's lots of general dentists. In fact, I'd bet, I don't know, but my guess is there's more general dentists that have a 1303 permit that are doing sedation via an oral route that will be affected by that change as well, not just the pediatric dentists. So we've got to understand that if we just stick with moderate sedation in the 1302, that's going to affect all those people. And when we had that discussion before, when we started down the 1302 section, it seemed like everyone was okay with that.
Ollie? Yeah, I totally see what you're saying, Heath. You know, in section 1302 at the beginning, it says moderate sedation, and then it goes on to say moderate sedation by any means. So, you know, continuing to have a 1303 that, sure, it seems redundant saying moderate sedation, but limiting the route to just oral route for 1303, I think there is a difference there between a 1303 and a 1302 permit holder, and that a 1303 can only do it by, you know, PO medications. So I guess I see where you're going, why have it there at all, but it would disrupt all of those current 1303 permit holders. And I also kind of worry that people might start thinking that, you know, without a permit, if I'm doing oral sedation, then it's going to be okay to maybe cross that line. I mean, not that it's okay, but there might be more risk of people crossing that line from a mild sedation to a moderate sedation on a conventional line.
Randy?
And I think these are all great points, but I would almost actually go back to Dr. Snell's original comment when we started this organization, which was, you know, what are we doing here and what are we really trying to prevent? Is there a problem in this state as far as oral sedation leading to adverse occurrences? And, you know, so I'm not so sure we need to really change the language that dramatically, although I do like getting away from the what we had defined as the route, right? I kind of like the way the 1300 is right now, except for, and I like what Dr. Caputo had said about the intent, but I don't like how we indicate the route. That's all I would have to say about it.
Anthony?
It's a challenge. I mean, it's a challenge that we're all identifying through our different comments, but it's one that I am very personal about because this is the heart of my wife's practice. So as a general dentist who sees children, she does minimal moderate oral sedation. And I do think it merits the distinction between parenteral versus enteral, because I do believe there's a difference. And I think it's the challenge of throwing yourself in a direction that says, well, we have to be committed to root versus level or level versus root. As much as I agree with the definitions by level, I do think there's a difference between a dentist or a doctor or otherwise trained individual administering oral moderate sedation versus IV or other types of parenteral approaches. It's something you guys are going to have to figure out, but there is a big difference. I for sure would tell you that. And it to put that level of onus on a general dentist that's not doing that level of moderate sedation training for example, what a lot of states are doing with the ADA guidelines, I think is tremendously well beyond what we do in Arizona. And I think it's valuable for us to maintain that. Thank you.
Keith.
So this is something I wasn't going to go back to because I didn't want to have everyone hate me. But in the, as I was reading again through the 1302 guidelines and stuff, it makes it such that if we just say moderate sedation, that anyone could come out from a, and I'm from any course where they didn't learn sedation through an IV route. They learned moderate sedation through an oral route, through multiple drugs, and they could get a 1302 permit and then administer IV sedation via IV. That's the way 1302, there's nothing that would preclude them from doing that, which I don't know if the board, if our intention is to make it such that if you're doing oral, if you took classes that taught you oral, the route of the oral way, then you only stick to that. If you did IV, you stick to that. But the way it's currently written is you would, anyone, even if they never started an IV in any of their courses, they could go back in practice and draw up drugs and give it intravenously for their sedation. So.
I think there's some verbiage in paragraphs there about a 1301-1302 being able to give oral medication. I think that's in the narrative as well.
Randy and then Jason. And then I'll leave.
I want to appreciate Dr. Caputo's points and Dr. Snell's, and maybe that's just kind of what our an error that I'm making or we're making is try to totally be in line with the ADA. There probably is nothing wrong with us leaving this one definition of moderate sedation via an oral route, and I honestly would probably okay with that. I certainly appreciate the differences that you've outlined, Dr. Snell, and what Dr. Caputo has said about his wife's practice, and I think the intent. I don't know why, I guess in my mind's eye, I was just trying to get more in line with other, you know, organizations, even my own. Amos has redefined, you know, their sedation levels as far as not using the level as it is to, or not the route, I should say, as to more the level. But I'd be okay with leaving, you know, 1303 moderate sedation via an oral route.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, from when I read these changes, I have some concerns with this. I think we're going to put a lot of dentists, both pediatric and general, into a real difficult position if we change this to minimal sedation. And I don't think there's anything wrong with digressing a little bit from what the ADA may currently be doing. That's my two cents. Who is next? Heath?
So I'm totally okay with that as well. I just think we need to go back then and in the 1302 put moderate sedation via parenteral route, because it's going to be very confusing if one of them is moderate sedation period and the other one is moderate sedation via oral route. Because if any it would be, if you got a 1302, it says in here that you can also do what a 1303 can do. So you by it implies that you could do oral sedation to a moderate level if you have your 1302, but it opens up the door for someone to do a 1302 permit and do IV, even though they have no training with that route of sedation.
Right. You're seeing a dentist that takes CE and moderate oral sedation may have the ability to get a 1302 permit based on the way the updated language reads. Is that what you're saying?
As far as I understand it and what I've read through, there's not correct. That's correct.
Jessica, do you have comments? Ollie, you had your hand up at one point. Did you have a comment?
Well, I had it up to, it was kind of addressed by others, but, you know, I took it down because I want to look through what Dr. Snell was mentioning. And yeah, he's right. Where it talks about the requirements for the 1302, there isn't any mention of it needing to be training in intravenous. It could be an oral sedation course. So, you know, one, when I raised my hand, it was to say, you know, that Dr. Snell had, and what Dr. Caputo had said really hit it on the head of why we need to maintain that the 1303 with moderate sedation via an oral route. And then, you know, there'll be many other dentists other than Dr. Caputo's wife who would be affected by that. But then, you know, what Dr. Snell's saying, somebody could do a course in moderate sedation via an oral route. And under the way we have the rules written, they would qualify. And then now they'd be allowed to do IV conscious sedation. And they have no clue necessarily what they're doing. So I think it's a great point that we need to go back and add that in, that the training needs to be by the intravenous or parenteral route.
Dr. Lout?
Yeah, I support what he said 100%. I think that's a great idea. You know, my situation is I'm the representative for the 348. I believe that's the number of people that have 1303 permits. And in preparing this, you know, a lot of people are doing the triazolam where you do a couple doses of more than a 1.5, which, you know, I think when you start using those drugs at that level, then you are kind of leaning more towards the moderate. But reading the minimal and the moderate, you know, the criteria in that, working with pediatric patients, if you read both of those, there's, you know, the pediatric patient kind of falls in between there. It could go either which way. And it's just, you know, when you use more drugs and things like that, I think you're more leaning towards the moderate. But from a pediatric perspective, you know, and the anesthesiologist may differ from me, but I think if you read the verbiage and everything, the middle to moderate is very similar for a pediatric patient as far as oral goes.
Anthony?
This anesthesiologist would agree with you.
Thank you.
So, Jessica, what do you think the best way is to accomplish the intent of what we're talking about right now?
So it sounds to me like there is a difference between moderate sedation via oral versus, I think it was parenteral. And it does sound like you want to keep moderate sedation via oral in 1303, which means that I agree. I think you should go back to 1302 and clarify that that is the opposite.
Anthony?
Would you all be okay with saying enteral route versus oral? Thank you.
I would, but I think it would confuse a lot of dentists.
I agree with Dr. Blazek. And I believe we had talked about this in the subcommittee as well, sticking with oral versus oral.
Yeah, I was actually going to recommend going the other way and calling it in 1302 intravenous instead of parenteral, if there's any. I'd rather say intravenous and oral than parenteral and enteral. Yeah, I think it could be confusing to some people who don't know.
What, Anthony? Sorry, I didn't raise my hand. Sorry.
The only challenge with the 1302 is that the IM route and the IN route and the sublingual route are available to those providers, not just the IV route.
That's a great point.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. That's exactly what I would say. I think we define enteral and parenteral. It's in the definitions already, I believe. If it's not, we should have it in there. And then anyone that's completed dental school should be able to look at that definition and look at the 1303 and say, okay, this is what it means.
Randy?
Anthony, I'm sorry. I was kind of joking when I said that, but because it would be kind of sad if someone's doing oral sedation or IV sedation, and they didn't know the difference. I was kind of joking about it, but unfortunately, I guess that does really happen. So,
it would be people considering it that could get confused more so than the people that actually qualify to get it.
Dr. Lau?
Yeah, in consideration of that discussion, I think it's a good idea to go parenteral and enteral.
Jessica, other than amending kind of that title line, are there more changes we would need to go back in the 1302 permit? Language and change?
Off the top of my head, we might need to change definitions and clarify moderate sedation.
Could I task you with looking at that after the meeting so that we don't have to occupy more time trying to go back through line by line and figure that out right now?
Yeah. Yeah. And just to clarify, so 1302 is going to be enteral or no?
Parenteral.
Okay.
Jessica, I don't know if you have previous copies or if this is a live document that you don't have previous ones, but if we go back to stating parenteral, that's the way I had originally worded everything, similar to what 1303 is now, that you might be able to go back and just find that document to help you make those changes throughout the 1302 section.
Jessica, it's listed in our board packet. It's just crossed out. So in the committee packet, that was dispersed for this meeting. If you look at R411-1302, it says parenteral moderate sedation with parenteral crossed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll go through and fix the 1302 to make sure it references the parenteral, and then I will, instead of doing via oral route, I'm assuming this will be enteral moderate sedation.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like the committee is saying.
Okay.
And Ryan, maybe you can just send an email blast out explaining the difference to parenteral and enteral for any dentists that don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was playing out. I was writing it down.
Okay, you could put it in your in that update you guys were sending out. I think that's a good idea.
Actually, Randy, like I said, from your email address.
Perfect.
Okay, so if we are making 1303 enteral moderate sedation, do you still want it to say via an oral route, or the enteral covers that and we can take that off?
You can take that out.
I think the enteral moderate sedation's good.
Okay. So I can update section A too, to refer to administering enteral moderate sedation, take off via an oral route.
Then we can probably forge ahead.
And similarly to 1301 and 1302, I'm assuming we want this to track with regard to the pediatric permit.
Dr. Lau, that's correct, right? I know you guys met on that.
And that is correct.
Okay. So I think I'm okay with all of the changes in what you're looking to do up until A2, the administration of a single dose of a single drug for minimal sedation. Because we're in moderate sedation, we now want all references to minimal sedation here to instead be enteral moderate sedation, correct?
Well, so I think this, I think this number 2A and B is just trying to say that you don't need this permit for minimal oral sedation and defining what that means. But I think it reads sloppily.
Okay.
Heath, you got your hand up?
Yeah, I was just going to say it probably needs some. I had taken out what's the red line. That's the original stuff. And tried to wordsmith it to make it sound a little better for what I perceived the intent of the original guideline to be. Because I think this is important to keep in there, that allows dentists who don't have a permit to be able to provide one triazolam and then half of that dose again of triazolam, not mixing drugs, and only up to 1.5 MRD. I think we should leave that in there because that can be very valuable without needing a permit. But it does, I tried to reword it a little bit, but this is just one attempt. So we can reword it more.
What if two read a 1303 permit is not needed if, and then we hit that in A and B? Dr. Lout?
I'm comfortable with that. I think we our intention was to put this in there for a reason. That's why we put this narrative in. Just to like what Dr. Caputo said earlier, to allow the general dentist or any other specialty to go with sedation and not have to get a permit for the other stuff. But I agree with you. If you want to go ahead and state it the way that you just did, that would be great.
Heath?
I like that, Anthony, for that first part. And then I would recommend, I just, the what's red line to me seems kind of weird that you can only do, you can do up to the maximum MRD, the first dose, but then half of the second dose. But the intent is that you can't supersede 1.5 times the MRD. Does it really matter if you do 0.75 of the amount and 0.75 the second time? Does it have to be all or nothing? Like, to me, if I'm thinking of a provider and I want to be as safe as possible, but I know I'm limited to this, well, I'm going to give the full maximum recommended dose the first time just in case, because I only have another half amount to go beyond that. Whereas if I know I can go up to 1.5 total, then maybe I'll start with half the maximum recommended dose. And if I see it's doing absolutely nothing, then I can give more. I think it's more freeing with the way I wrote it in blue versus the way it was originally written, but still sticks to the same purpose of not superseding that 1.5 times maximum recommended dose.
And what you wrote is in blue?
Correct.
So if number two read, a 1303 permit is not required if, and then you go to a single the administrated dose is within the FDA maximum recommended dose. See, you want to lose the during minimal sedation part as well, right? I think that might muddy it.
I would put the administered, well, is the intent to go to allow up to 1.5 the MRD or to stay just at the MRD?
I would probably leave out, I would just have it the administration of a drug for minimal sedation does not require a section 1303 permit if, and then the way it is spelled out here, I think that would be appropriate. That would, I think that would provide a little bit more clarity.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with that, Heath?
I don't, it, yeah, sure. It doesn't, I'm not.
Yeah, I would think that would read much better.
Okay, so A2 we'll read that the administration of minimal sedation does not require a Section 1303 permit if, and then A should be the administered dose does not exceed. Is that where you were going?
Yeah, I would still leave. I would still leave the word drug in to the administration of a drug for a minimal sedation does not require. I would still leave drug in there.
Okay, but still take out the single dose.
I think, yeah, I think it would be clear to take that out, and then you can go straight to the definition below or the discussion below.
Okay. And then, so A should be the administered dose. Do you still want to stay within the FDA maximum, or do you want to strike all of that and put in does not exceed 1.5 times the FDA maximum?
It's a good question.
I think the administered, you're implying, if you say the administered dose, you're implying they could give N that one dose 1.5 MRD, which I don't know, is there anything wrong with that in a setting if at home they can do up to the MRD without anyone next to them? Can we allow them to do one dose of 1.5? I would think that would be okay, but that's how I would read that if I was looking at this on what I could do as a provider without any permits. Is I could give one dose, up to one dose at 1.5, the maximum recommended dose if we change that.
Anthony?
I think you guys are working really hard on this. I don't think the original language is really that bad if you look at it. To Heath's point, that language was changed at that time for exactly the rationale that he presented, was that it previously said the dentist could only administer a single dose of a single drug, and the board revisited that and found that was a little restrictive. The way that current rules read is everything that you guys are saying, and it clearly states that they can give a supplemental dose that cannot exceed 1/2 the amount of the initial dose. The reason why I like that language is if the patient received 0.25 milligrams of triazolam, it doesn't mean that the dentist now can give them 0.5 to get up to that 1.5 times. They actually could only give them 0.125. So I think there's a built-in safety to the current language. I might encourage you to revisit it, but I think it's actually pretty good the way it's written, and it really accomplishes everything you guys are talking about. Thank you.
Jason? No, I agree. It's the same thought process that I had about it. And that's why that safety mechanism is built in there.
So, Keith, Dr. Lau, are you okay just leaving this as is?
I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, I'm fine. I wonder.
Great.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So am I hearing then no changes to 2 or its subsections as they're currently written in rule?
I think so.
So we will leave in the language that's stricken, leave out the language that's in blue.
I will say one thing though, it's kind of contradictory to me when you say the administration of a single dose of a single drug, blah, 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 and then incremental multiple doses of the drug may be administered. That's contradictory to me. You could put the administration of a single drug and take out the single dose. But if you're allowing for incremental dosing, as long as you don't reach the maximum recommended dose, that's contrary to the administration of a single dose of a single drug.
My recommendation
would be the administration of a single drug for minimal sedation, and then leave everything else as the way it was written.
Dr. Arnell?
Okay.
I just had one quick comment on this. I recall actually looking at these sections when I was practicing general dentistry, and I would just suggest if not to require a permit, maybe just say it does not require a permit. Because I recall reading this and going, okay, it doesn't require a 1303 permit, so what permit does it require? It would just be very simple to just say it does not require a permit.
I'm okay with that too.
This is Jessica. So I guess I have a question then, because if you leave it at just the administration of a single drug for minimal sedation does not require a section 1303 permit, period, does that mean that then that single dose could exceed that FDA maximum or 1.5 of the maximum? And does it also mean that if they are using a single dose, or excuse me, if they use more than one dose because they don't get the effect that they want in the first dose, that now they do need a permit?
Jessica, I think what he's saying is you put the administration of a single drug for minimal sedation does not require a 1303 permit if you still leave the, or sorry, does not require a permit if, and then you have the parameters outlining like it previously was written.
Okay.
Ollie, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, we've talked an awful lot about the levels of sedation. Should we add anything in here that says that you can't continue giving incremental doses if the patient goes beyond a minimal level of sedation? And we're just talking about the dose, and especially these days where we see patients that come in and lie about the drugs that they took. You might give, 0.5 of the recommended maximum dose, and they're in a deeply sedated state. So I don't know if we should just add anything talking about the,
I think it is the intent in that number two, the administration for minimal sedation.
So if you leave the language as is, you also have little I that talks about incremental multiple doses of the drug may be administered until the desired effect is reached.
Which is minimal sedation is your desired effect.
Right. So what I'm hearing is that you guys want to leave this as is.
Yes.
And B as well.
Yes.
I think that's a good sense. Yes.
Okay.
And I think up above, under two, under A, Dr. Arnell had recommended taking out section 1303. Just going to permit. I think that's a good change.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Is there anything else on subsection A before we move on to subsection B? So the first change that we have here is just an update to the reference from 1307 to 1308. And all the references, we'll double check those to make sure that they're accurate based on all the changes that you guys have made before it's finalized. Sorry, guys, my computer's been really slow today.
Ollie? Yeah, just the one thing to change. A lot of these references that lined out R411 1307 to R411 1308, that's from some changes that probably will be reversed. So those probably all need to go back to R411 1307.
Okay. So that brings us to number two, forms provided by the board provide a dated and signed affidavit attesting that any dental office or dental clinic or the dentist will administer, and then we'll change that to enteral moderate sedation. Brings us down to 2AV. Basically contains the following properly operating equipment and supplies during the provision of sedation. There was a recommendation, it looks like, to add precordial and pretracheal stethoscope.
Jason, and then Heath after him.
So it's a little bit interesting to me, and I'm not sure how to handle this. We just say emergency drugs. There's a lot of different emergency drugs out there. Emergency drugs to handle ACLS, PALS. It's very vague. But then we go into specifying all the emergency equipment, and we're very specific to that. And I know the evaluation sheets talk about certain drugs, specific drugs in the evaluation, which is not in the regulation here. So is there a way for us to stay consistent on this? Either keep it vague and then define what it is in the evaluation sheets for people to refer to, because that's what they're going to be tested on, and then that can be updated a little bit more easier, or do we spell out all the emergency drugs as we do in the forms and as we are doing with resuscitative equipment or supplies?
Heath?
That's a great question. I just to answer my opinion on that, I would say leave it as is. And then on the evaluation sheets, it seems easier to update those than to go through this whole process again should different emergency drugs come about. And emergency drugs for a 1303 to me seems completely different than a 1302 because they don't even know how to start an IV and they're not going to need those same emergency drugs that a 1302 would. So rather than laying them out very specifically here, just default to the evaluation forms and then they know what drugs those are that they have to have. The one thing comment that I was going to make beyond that, not answering the question, was just a little V there, number 5 2AV. I think we could take, I don't know if it's highlighted to take it out, but it's a ventilation monitor was added in. So that's kind of a duplicate there. So I think we could take out V because you have the last one that we added there.
Dr. Arnell?
I was just going to kind of echo what Jason and Heath said. You know, I think that's a great principle to make those lists of specifics on a more easily changeable format because, for example, Sugammadex and Ryanodex, the last time that these rules were evaluated, were not available to anybody. Now they're fantastic medications that we have access to that we can use for emergencies. And, you know, equipment is constantly evolving also. I think this idea that Jason brought up of having these kinds of things that are in constant change on lists that are easily changeable rather than on rules that we revisit every decade or so, I think that's a great idea. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Any suggestions on how you'd want to do that, Dr. Brady?
Sure. I mean, you would just basically redline out, strike out all the equipment, and then emergency drugs would be emergency drugs and equipment.
Are we on the wrong page on Jessica's form here? I'm kind of lost.
Yeah, I lost my network connection, so I'm a little lost as well.
Jessica's like on page 19, and it's talking about completion of CPR, and so I'm a little confused. I mean, I know what we're trying to talk about, but the document I'm looking at is not related to what we're talking about.
I'm slowly but surely trying to scroll.
Thank you. I just appreciate it.
Okay, you should be able to see where you are.
Okay, so just so this is the requirements for a 1303 we're looking at here?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, Dr. Lau.
Yes, I got cut off. I'll toss this out to the group. Would it be okay if we just eliminated stethoscope and put precordial, pretracheal stethoscope there? On second hand, we might want to leave stethoscope there because they've got to listen to the patient before giving them medication. So maybe we should leave stethoscope there.
I would leave stethoscope, but precordial is redundant in that it is already listed in item number 9. Is that 9? Yes, it's 9, I think. Under ventilatory monitor.
Oh, nice pickup. Thank you.
Ollie?
So what Dr. Brady mentioned of just having this only say emergency drugs and monitoring equipment. So if it was taken out of rule, where would that list be generated of what people need to have and how would they need to know what they need to have?
So I'll just jump in and answer it since it's kind of what I was talking about, but it basically what I'm saying as reference to your evaluation, like we do evaluations on a certain frequency and those evaluation forms can be updated on that type of frequency. So the standard is as you were tested. And maybe it won't fly. My big issue with this is we were really specifying a lot of emergency equipment here and we're not really spelling out the emergency drugs. So in one, we're very vague and one, we're very specific. And I think if we stayed like emergency drugs and equipment as specified by the evaluation forms, it has the pointer to those forms that everyone has been evaluated to hold that type of permit. So there is a reference for them to go to or, you know, a document for them to look at to get the specifics of what the board is looking for. I think it's just as more of a living process, document process than it is here, right? I mean, I think these things, even though they don't change that often, I think that they can change. Like we're talking about pretracheal stethoscopes, and I think that's totally relevant. I support that 100%, but I don't know if this is the right document for that, but maybe it is. And so my question is it the correct place to list out everything? And if so, why aren't we listing out the drugs?
And Dr. Brady, just a point of clarification, you're posing this question for all permits, not just the 13.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Caputo. Dr. Blazek.
Oh, I'm here. Sorry.
I
had muted myself twice, but it was a nice segue asking about all permit levels. And so this is a question maybe for Jessica to respond to. But what if you just put in there for each permit level, appropriate drugs, equipment, and supplies? For emergency response or appropriate emergency drugs, equipment, and supplies. And then you could delineate that on each of the evaluation forms per permit level. I just don't know if appropriate becomes problematic from a regulatory level. So thank you.
Jessica, you want to answer that before I move to, there's a few other members that have their hands up.
Yeah, so if you're, forgive me, I'm thinking through this as we go as well. So basically we're talking about the provider signing an affidavit saying that any dental office or clinic where they are performing enteral moderate sedation has the following equipment and supplies. Is there a difference between the equipment and supplies that they need to have on hand from a 1303 permit standpoint versus a 1302 or a 1301?
Yes,
I guess is my first question.
Yes, absolutely. The different permit levels are definitely going to require different levels of rescue with different drugs and equipment.
Okay. And is that, so if they require different drugs and equipment, is there a list or a standard out there somewhere that you can refer to that would deem, you know, this set of drugs and equipment is appropriate for this permit level versus another list of appropriate equipment and drugs for that permit level?
Correct. And those are found in the forms with the evaluation forms that are already created in the state. So, I mean, those may need to be updated. I'm not suggesting that those are perfect. I'm just saying that those forms may be the place to have these updates.
Okay. And the forms, because this rule is referring to on forms provided by the board. So are those forms, in fact, the forms that are being used to identify those various appropriate supplies and equipment?
They are during the evaluation process.
I guess what I'm saying is this, when it's talking about the dated and signed affidavit, that affidavit seems to be the very form that identifies the appropriate
Right. And so maybe the affidavit has to, maybe the affidavit has to be revised to specify that. You know, I mean, the way I read this now is like, okay, I take, you know, I get my permit level. It's been 3 or 4 years in. Oh, I need to refresh my emergency drugs. I go back to the rules and regs. It just says emergency drugs. So now all I'm carrying is succinylcholine, which is completely inappropriate. And it's not what I've been evaluated on. So I think we need to either have that document source be the form and then the affidavit saying that you are to maintain those unexpired drugs and equipment that are specified on that evaluation or however that may be.
So typically my recommendation is any form or document or requirement that is regulating the community should be in your rules, because it's not enforceable unless it's in your statute or your rules. And so if you have forms that are requiring your providers, your regulated community to have certain things, I would recommend that those certain things be in the rule.
Okay. Then we have to update I to be quite more expansive than what I is, where it just says emergency drugs, which is fine. I mean, I'm not saying that's
not. Jason, can you just put the categories of drugs like they have it on the evaluation form, like a vasopressor and a bronchodilator, so you don't list specific on this form?
Sure, but at least it becomes consistent that way, right? It matches what Jessica is saying that needs to be done. It's just that the form, now we have to make sure that the form matches what the regulations are, and we're going to go through all the permit levels and update I to be what the forms say.
Dr. Blazek, did you have a comment?
Well, I wrote something. I liked where Jason was going with this before Jessica spoke. So I wrote something in the chat about how we can maybe reword it similar to what Dr. Caputo had said. Because I really like where you guys are going with it. But based on Jessica's comments, I guess then we should consider making the medications more in line with the actual evaluation form, which is easily referenced through the board. Susie can provide those, and we can add those, you know, as far as the categories of drugs that we require the permit holder to have. But I liked going with a more minimal approach because things do change. I agree. So I had written something in the chat that I thought might work. It's a little wordy, verbose, maybe not the greatest, but I like the concept until Jessica said otherwise.
Jessica?
So I'm also thinking about this from an enforceability standpoint. And if you're requiring certain drugs based on the permit level, you know, and they're different and they're specific on the form, then I would think you would want to have those in rule as well, so that you don't have a regulated person coming back and saying, well, you know, you failed me on my review because I had this drug and not that drug, or I didn't qualify for this particular permit because I had X instead of Y.
Ryan?
Jessica just said exactly what I wanted to say. The one thing, the forms will need to be updated also, and we'll cover that. And I think we're kind of waiting to get through this process to do that. But I had a question, I think, more for Jason, because you just went through this. Or I said that again. Sorry, Dr. Brady. You just went through this with Massachusetts. Was it Massachusetts?
Mississippi.
Mississippi. Did you guys list the drugs in that rule similar to this, or?
You know what? I have to go back and look. I don't know. I'll look at that real quick. I can actually pull that up. Just give me a second. I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Because I agree with Jessica. I think if we just say as appropriate, and Seamus, you may want to weigh in on this too. I'm not sure. But I think if we get to an issue where the board votes somebody to a hearing or denies somebody a permit and then there's a hearing process and we are not specifically stating what those are and we just say appropriate, then it's subjective to who the reader or the hearing officer is to know whether or not what's appropriate as opposed to what isn't. And they could have a more compelling argument. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Dr. Caputo?
So there's a few things on the table here, but I guess the reason why I was asking about Jessica's input on my comment was appropriate allows then the evaluation form to be the determinant of drugs, equipment, and supplies for each permit level. I think the whole idea is that it would be actually inappropriate to list specifically in rule because as we're discussing, things change. But then on top of that, you have different things available that one person may like over another, and you don't want to feel as though they're obligated to have that particular item. And I think that's why, sort of back to Jason's comment, that's why it currently says emergency drugs instead of listing those specific drugs. So there are some different ways to handle this, but I think at the end of the day, the opportunity is to make this a lot simpler, to put it in as a simple comment regarding the language. I would also just say from an enforceability standpoint, I'm not aware of any case where there was a adverse event or otherwise related to a permit that it went back to what drugs, equipment, or supplies the person had at the time of that procedure. So I don't know this is as much an enforceability issue because of that. So I don't think it's as relevant. So I still think you could keep it simple here. And I get that the recommendation is to not be more generalized, but I do think it has merit here. Thank you.
Dr. Arnell?
I just wanted to jump in that I did look back in Mississippi. They do keep it vague. And they, you know, they're just basically that you're using the forms that you're evaluated on.
Dr. Arnell?
I just wanted to comment the way that this is actually written, it is intended from the beginning, if you look in section two, to reference the licensee to these forms, right? So and this is actually how it's been done for quite a while. The list of emergency drugs, unless I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it's always been on this form, not listed in the rules. And I think it'll work much better to continue with that spirit and just say, that the licensee signs the affidavit agreeing that they will have the emergency drugs listed on their evaluation form and the equipment listed on their evaluation form. Maybe we even put the reference to that form in the language there. And then I think that accomplishes everything except for maybe, I forget who brought up the point, you know, maybe someone gets their permit and then the form changes and later they're held accountable for the change. Maybe we just say that they agree to have the drugs listed on the form as it was constituted the day of their evaluation. And then I think that would take care of everything, right? It would allow it to be, as Jason said, a living document that stays current with the current trends in anesthesia. And it would allow the board to stay current with their requirements for anesthesia. And then it also gives protection to the licensee who can say, no, I have what was listed on the form that on the day that I took my evaluation. That's all.
Ollie?
Yeah, I guess my question is, you know, as we all know, what's here isn't what's on the evaluation form. So I'm just curious, who does create the specifics that end up on the evaluation form? And then in deciding whether or not we should get more detailed or more vague in rule would be a question of, do we feel that this committee should be the ones deciding what the specifics on the form are, or should we leave it to whoever's doing it currently or somebody else?
Ryan, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, but I don't have a really good answer. I don't know who the forms were not created since I've been here. And I believe it was probably from a previous committee similar to this that created evaluation forms. They need to be changed, as do the notification letters and some other things. But I think we should get through this process before we change the forms. But it should definitely match what the rule is or statute. We shouldn't be doing more or less. We should be following the statute, and I'm sure Seamus would agree.
Dr. Blazek?
I think I forgot what I was going to say, but I do know the forms have been the same since 2003 when I took my first exam. There was one time where we told someone we were supposed to have oxygen, and the provider that had an adverse occurrence did run out of oxygen. So there are cases out there where even though we tell people what to do, unfortunately, you still have, mistakes.
Jessica?
Yeah, so I understand the need to be flexible, and I understand, you know, that you want the ability to have the forms updating, you know, as the industry updates. I do want to suggest a couple of things just in terms of how the rule writing process works. The fact that you have this language in there as emergency drug will probably generate less scrutiny from the powers that be currently reviewing these rules at the end of the day, versus making changes to those, to that language, and inviting more scrutiny as to why you're making those changes and why you're making the changes that you're making. Meaning, if you want to change emergency drug to something else, either more specific or less specific and more general, that's going to generate more scrutiny either way, right? Making a change as opposed to typically leaving it alone generates less scrutiny. The reason I bring that up is because the current administration at GIRC is very specific about making sure that whatever changes you're making regulating your professional licensing community are necessary. And they want to make sure that you're not imposing any unnecessary burdens. I could see them being a little bit nervous if you make changes and say that, you know, it's just going to be whatever is we determine is appropriate on our form, and there's no oversight either from the board or from GIRC, frankly, on what those forms are when you're changing them to require more or less of either drugs or equipment or whatever it is.
Thank you, Jessica. Keith.
So I think most of you know, generally my opinion is to be less legislative and prescriptive. My one concern in this, if we left it very vague and only went to what was referenced on the forms, is if whoever makes that decision, it's not to change those forms. From what I can understand, it's not up to, it doesn't give an opportunity for anyone in the public to speak to, oh, you're adding the need for capnography for moderate sedation, shall we say. I don't think that's necessary, and here's why, and here's some research that shows it's not necessary. It doesn't give them the opportunity to participate in that process. The forms are just written, however they're written, and then they're put out there, and then as a provider, I have to go along with it rather than following what's here and going through this process that we're going through. Something like that were to come about and some big change like that were to happen, it gives the public and providers an opportunity to chime in and say, wait a second, why are we being more prescriptive on these things? So that would be my only concern about leaving it only in the forms where it's not open for the public to have a voice. But I'm all for keeping it open. I like that.
Dr. Love?
Yeah, this is to answer Ollie's question earlier in Randy's. It was a committee like this that put things together probably about 2001, 2002. Because there wasn't a permit for oral sedations at that time. We could pretty much do sedation oral without a permit. So, those forms were, the drugs that were used came out of a committee just like this that determined which drugs would be used.
Thank you, Dr. Lau. So in reading the comments on the side, there some consensus as to a next step, which, Dr. Blazek, you suggested it. Why don't you, explain it and see if Ryan can help accomplish it.
So what I think would be a great idea is we could provide the evaluation forms for the next meeting, and we could go through the different classes of drugs that they're listed on there and then incorporate those classes of drugs under the emergency drugs if we decide to be more prescriptive, as Jessica is indicating. And I can tell you as an evaluator, and I'm sure – you know, all you guys would say the same thing. We're not looking for specific drugs. We're looking for the ability to handle a type of emergency, hypertensive, hypotensive, epileptic, you know, whatever it may be. And as long as the individual has that, you know, something in there. I mean, like so many guys now, they don't carry Valium for their anti-epileptic. They carry, you know, that's their, and we let that go is an evaluation. So if we decide to be prescriptive, let's use the forms that we currently use. And if we feel we need to modify them in this form, we can do that. Meaning only listing them as the drugs. That's what our thoughts were.
Yeah, so we can put everything together, board staff can, and then add that as an agenda item. I don't know if we'll have to make a separate agenda item, but they'll be for your review. That's what led to this committee to start, because when I got here, I was like, oh, this is kind of a little messy situation with the permits. And then I talked to the board at the time, and they created this committee. And ultimately, the goal is to have everybody be evaluated on the same level for the permit that they're trying to get and follow the statute and rules that are guiding how people get permitted. So we may be doing a little too early, but I get the reason why. And so we can put together everything. I'm not sure exactly. We'll work with the attorney's office to figure out how we're going to look at it on the agenda. And I'll probably count on Susie and Sherry more than myself, because I don't send these documents out.
Can't we, Ryan, can't we just add them as a document like we did previously when Dr. Brady gave us the new kind of proposed regulations. I think that was from the NSDA, Jason. I can't remember what it was. That was a nice document you guys circulated for us to read. You know, and it just helped us, you know, develop. So that's what I'm looking at is just the forms to provide a document for us to use to say, okay, here's the emergency classes of drugs. We're going to make a recommendation be listed in the statutes. Not that we're changing the forms.
Okay, yeah. So we probably can just add the forms as a part of this heading, because you're using the forms to create the language of the rule as opposed to using the rule to change the forms. I think that part needs to come as well, but I think I understand the fight that you need.
That's what I was saying. Perfect, yeah.
Okay. Great, thank you. Dr. Arnell.
I think Randy hit on, or Dr. Blazek hit on a really good idea. If it does have to be prescriptive in the rules, then listing the drug classes still allows some flexibility as, you know, drug classes and equipment classes. It allows some flexibility as the industry changes to, you know, use updated drugs in those classes. Anyway, I think it's kind of
a different solution to the same problem. And I think there's value in that suggestion that Dr. Blasek put in the group chat.
Great. Thank you. All right. We're coming up to 4:30. Dr. Brady, I think we're losing you at 4:30. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have another board meeting that I have to jump onto. So, my time is limited, but, I think we just meet a quorum too. So if we're not at it like a natural spot, I can just be late at the next one.
I mean, to me, we kind of are at a natural stopping point, and, board staff has, a meeting after this starting at 5 o'clock. So I think the breaking point now would probably be good for them as well. But Ollie, why don't you go ahead before we adjourn?
Yeah, no, I just thinking of the idea of quorum. Last week I switched to my car and was listening and couldn't speak when we were talking about the issues with that. And I think the committee decided to not add additional members. But what about removing some members? So that is there a requirement to have a set number of people on this committee? Could we, I know Dr. Beanstalk hasn't been on a meeting in probably 2 years. You know, could we remove some members so that we at least can get our, you know, quorum number based on the number of members?
Well, before we get too much into this, why don't we jump to well, Ryan, where can we talk about this? Should we just continue here since Seamus isn't here to yell at us?
I think he is. He's online.
Okay.
We can probably talk. Probably under summary of current events, no real vote. You could direct staff to do certain things and discussion of possible future items as well, something like that.
Okay, then let's jump to agenda item number 7, discussion and possible action items for future meetings. Dr. Blasek.
I was going to echo what Ali said, in particular Dr. Beanstalk, and, you know, not having attended quite a few of the meetings. But I would also say that I'm really comfortable and happy with how this core group is moving. And I think if we go back to when this committee was created, some of us, myself included, jumped in at it because we were worried what was going to happen. And I feel that the committee has changed. I don't feel that way right now. I do feel a general sense of like, look, we're just trying to update the statutes and stuff. And so my point being, at this point, some individuals who don't want to make a lot of meetings, they might be like, you know, I'd rather just pull off the committee. And I think that's okay to do, you know, as opposed to expanding the committee or whatever. Change the requirement for the quorum, I think, would be a good idea. And then the other comment I was going to make, I guess, would be more new business or whatever, but it's interesting we have in here about the cardiac defibrillator and the AED. And I know we had early on made a recommendation that the board mandate that to all dental practices. And I'm not sure if everybody follows, but in the legislative process this last session, that was one of the items that was brought up. And I think I actually emailed our lobbyists to find out if it came out of our group or the board, and it didn't. So there was some sort of legislative requirement for all dental offices to have an AED, I thought, in the last legislative process.
Do you mind, Dr. Hero?
Yeah, no, I was going to defer to you anyway, Ryan.
So we can add these things to another agenda item, like you said. It was in the legislative session. It was brought by this board. It was Senate Bill 1240. They actually took that vehicle and used it for a ton of other things. And the response we got back was, and I think it's because of all the vaccine mandates and all these things across the country, the response was, I think it's a good idea and we should encourage it, but I'm not going to sponsor a bill that mandates it. And so they removed it from, and they wouldn't even hear the bill mandating an AED in the practice. So kind of stupid reason, but going back to the quorum issue, we can add another item. We can add it back on. The struggle that we have, and I'll tell you that staff, we rip our hair out probably every single week when we're trying to get a quorum and find out if we have a quorum. We still don't know if we have a quorum next week, Dr. Caputo, for the investigative committee. It seems like a simple process. There's a button in the email or a link in the email. All you got to do is edit and then answer whether or not you're going to be here. And so we're just going to try. We didn't know we were going to have a quorum until probably 10 minutes before this meeting today. So we were hopeful that there would be a quorum. Having 11 members, you have a quorum of six. If you have 10 members, you still have a quorum of six. That's why I was encouraging you to add somebody. But you can drop it to 9, and then the quorum's 5. You can drop it to 7, the quorum's 4. So there are things you can do, and I can add this to the agenda if that's what the committee's pleasure is for the next meeting.
Dr. Caputo.
Oh, sorry. I just was going to say that Ryan's hair looks good. Sorry.
Yeah, and I want to make sure we don't have too much discussion around this, guys. I apologize. I am the wet blanket of the party. So if you do want to direct staff, I would just do that and hold it for next meeting. Thank you.
Hey, Seamus. Dr. Blazek wrote a comment. He's suggesting a dictatorship. I've been pushing for that on the board as well, but I don't think it's going to fly. So yeah, why don't we get this on the agenda? I will say I'm going to advocate for Dr. Beanstalk. I know she's missed a few meetings, but my preference would be being that she's an officer on the board, and it's nice to have, in a committee size that's even 9, 3 board members being myself, Dr. Christensen, and Dr. Beanstalk. But we can certainly agendize this for our next meeting and discuss it then. So,
and to her defense, she did say she's never going to attend a Tuesday meeting because she just can't. So when we alternated it, she said, I can't. So,
okay. Any other comments before we adjourn? All right. Appreciate you guys. I mean, you know, the group here has really made a strong effort to come to all these meetings. And I know particularly on behalf of board staff, that's meaningful. They put a lot of time and effort into planning these, and the quorum is a constant concern that I get to hear about the days leading up to the meeting. So on behalf of myself and all the board, we thank you guys for attending today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Blazek, go ahead.
Just real quick, Dr. Harrell, this is probably way crazy, but I know I have a lot of meetings I'm part of and try to get people organized. And sometimes instead of email, can they text just requesting a quorum? Because someone's typically a lot more quickly to respond on their cell phone than an email. Or is that not possible for board, for staff to text?
Ryan, you want to take that?
Yeah, we probably can figure out a way to send a link to your phone in a text. And that may be, Yasmin, I don't know if you're present, but that may be a good idea that we collect cell phone numbers to accept texts. And then at least we can send out the Google form that way and get, because then you can just look and you could be at a volleyball game, Dr. Blazek, and hit yes or no. Perfect.
Okay. Well, if that's it, then I think we adjourn this meeting. And Ryan, we're on at 5, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You guys have a great night. And Ryan, board staff, I'll see you in about 20 minutes.